When I looked at the schedule 3 days ago, I saw that I was down for an hour and 15 minutes, but I think an hour and 15 minutes of me standing up and speaking is cruel and unusual punishment. So it's going to be, I prepared a talk that is the standard seminar length of 45 minutes. And so if you want to interrupt me and ask a lot of questions, that's good. If not, we can all go to coffee break there. You know? Okay, so what is this talk? I aim this talk at theorists because my understanding is that the audience here is composed mostly of theorists, and also because I don't pretend to have any great insights on how to do searches at the LHC that my experimental colleagues are not aware of. What I'm aiming to do is to give you a sense. This doesn't work. Do you have a? Give you a sense of how searches for new physics are carried out. Give you some rules of thumbs that I use when I think about searches at the Hadron Collider. And then, because the audience is mostly made of theorists, I'd like to point out some issues on the theoretical side. So first, I will start by saying something about cross sections, and I will talk about this thing called parton luminosities, which I find very useful to think about when I think about what's going on at the Hadron Collider. Then I will talk about the ingredients for discoveries. I will talk about different types of searches with some examples, and here is where I will make some comments on the theoretical issues. So when I think about first of all, we all know the LHC opens up a completely new energy regime. This is obvious. We all know that. I find that a very useful way of thinking about this, and a very useful way to develop some intuition, in particular in thinking about the current experiments at the Tevatron versus the experiments at the LHC, is to look at this quantity called parton-parton luminosity. So what is that? Hadron Collider is a collider of two broadband beams of partons, quarks, antiquarks, and gluons. And you can actually define an effective luminosity for a parton-parton collision as a function of the center of mass energy of the system. And I find this very useful to think about this. So what does this look like? So suppose you have some process, I plus J goes to X, where I and J are some partons, maybe quarks, maybe gluons. You can define the cross-section for this process at the center of mass energy of the parton-parton collision as root s hat. And then if you want to calculate the total cross-section for this process, pp to x, or pp bar to x, if you're thinking about the Tevatron, you'd basically convolute this cross-section with the parton luminosities. And you sum over all the i's and j's that give you this x. And you can rewrite it as like this. This is the cross-section. D sigma d tau, and tau here is the scale, is a scale variable, is the center of mass energy of the parton collision divided by the center of mass energy of the hadron collision. And so you can write it as this thing here called the parton-parton luminosity times the parton-parton cross-section. And the parton-parton luminosity, if you go through the algebra, is just given by this. So this gives you effectively the luminosity for a collision as a function of the parton-parton center of mass. So what does this look like? I should say that this is the only plot that I made myself, and so it's probably somewhat wrong. I did ask one of my students to check my code. It was only 15 lines of code, but it probably has two bugs in it. But then when I showed him my code, he saw that he was Fortran, and he had such a disgusting look on his face that I figured that it was better not to insist. So this is about right. It may have a factor of two here and there, or maybe more. But anyway, so what is this? This is a plot of this parton-parton luminosity, and when I multiply them by this factor, this is actually microbarns, as a function of the parton-parton energy, center of mass energy. And this is for the Tevatron, we have the glu-glu luminosity, this is blue, the QQ bar luminosity, which is in purple, and for the LHC, the glu-glu luminosity is black, and the QQ bar luminosity is red. And so now here, when you look at this, now you'll see why you'll see some interesting thing, and you'll see what are the relationship between the Tevatron and the LHC, and how much more of a reach the LHC gives you, and you can do also some quantitative things. Like, for example, I find it useful to divide the glu-glu luminosity of the LHC by the glu-glu luminosity of the Tevatron, or divide the QQ bar luminosity of the LHC by the QQ bar luminosity of the Tevatron. And when I do that, zooming in on the, well, this is zooming in on the 1 TV region, the less than 1 TV region, it shows, you know, the much larger reach of the LHC, and when I do the division, I get something like this. So this is, the black line is the ratio of LHC to Tevatron parton-parton luminosity as the function, as a function of the center of mass energy, and the red line is for QQ bar. And so you look at this plot and you derive a first very simplistic rule of thumb. If you look at 1 TV, there is a factor of 10 to the 6th between gluon-gluon luminosity at the Fermilab and the LHC. So if you have a 1 TV gluon-gluon process, one inverse femtobarn at Fermilab, I think now Fermilab has what, 5 or 6 inverse femtobarn? It corresponds to one inverse nanobarn at the LHC. For 1 TV QQ bar processes, one inverse femtobarn at Fermilab is like one inverse picobarn at the LHC. So this tells you immediately that the LHC will reach the limits, the energy limits of the Tevatron with a very little data. Okay, there's a factor of 1 million for glu-glu at 1 TV, and a factor of about 1,000 for QQ bar at 1 TV. So that's a rule of thumb that I like to keep in mind. And here's another rule of thumb that is perhaps not so obvious. These luminosities fall very, very steeply. This is a log scale, okay? So if you look at this curve, you find that in a multi-TV region, they fall by a factor of 10 every 600 GeV. So what does that mean? Well, if you produce some new state, because of the falling parton luminosities, you tend to produce it at threshold. And now suppose that you have a limit on some pair-produced object with a mass of, and you say, well, I haven't found it, and the limit is about 1 TV. So you say, okay, let me get more data, and how fast do I improve? So how does your sensitivity improve with data? And the answer is, since you go down by a factor of 10, every about 600 GeV, you improve it by about 300 GeV, or 30%, if you increase your luminosity by a factor of 10. So this is an important thing to remember. Improving sensitivity with luminosity is tough, because the cross-section, the parton luminosities fall very steeply with center of mass energy. So in this case, just by looking at this and doing it on the back of the envelope, you have a limit of 1 TV. You increase your luminosity by a factor of 10, and you're going to get a limit of 1.3 TV. Okay? So this, the message again here is that assuming that the detectors and the accelerator works well, you're going to reach almost the ultimate sensitivity soon. It's also useful to remember to look at this plot here, which gives us the standard model cross section for various processes. And I want to point out, of course, that this is a log scale, and so there are several orders of magnitude between cross sections. So it's good to keep this in mind when you think about new physics. For example, the BB bar cross section for high PT, meaning in this case greater than 30 GeV, is about 1 microbarn. The W cross-section is 60 nanobarn. The WW cross-section is 200 picobarn. The TT bar cross-section is 1 nanobarn. And this is the Higgs cross-section here. It's 10 to the minus 6 microbarn. So that's 1 picobarn. Okay? So there's this huge range of cross-section. And the most important thing, one of the most crucial things to remember is that the jet cross-section is enormous. okay? So, for example, the cross section is 0.1 picobarn per GV at 1 TeV, which means that if you run, if you have a data set of 10 inverse picobarn, which you should get very soon, you are going to have one event per GV with a PT jet cost, jet energy of 1 TeV, which is sort of the limit of where the Tevatron has gotten. Okay, so these rates are enormous. There's another rule of thumb which is useful to think, to keep in mind when you, especially when you think about backgrounds. And the rule of thumb is that if you have the cross section for something, and you add a jet to the something with moderate transverse momentum, the cross section goes down by about an order of magnitude. So each time you add a jet, you go down by about an order of magnitude to your cross section, roughly. But this is a good rule of thumb to keep in mind when you think about what can you do with a given search. Okay, so these are the ingredients for a discovery at the LHC. There are 3 + 1 ingredients. The zeroth ingredient is that the detector and the machine must work, and of course if they don't work, then you can forget about it. So we're going to assume that they work. Everybody asks the questions, how fast will they come up? How fast will the machine come up? How fast will the detectors come up? I have no idea. One thing that I'm pretty sure of is that they won't come up very fast. These are very complicated instruments to commission and to make work. Then there's a very important ingredient that you cannot forget is the trigger. If you did not trigger, it never happened. Okay? If you did not trigger, it never happened. So if you think about a search or a new signature, the first thing that you should think about as a theorist is, are they triggering on it? And if we're not triggering on it, and you think you have the greatest theory in the world, we're not going to be able to look at it. So you have to come to us and tell us, hey, you guys better figure out how to trigger on this because it's so great. And then maybe we'll say, okay, we'll try it, or we'll say, go away, forget it, it's impossible. Okay. So I will spend a couple of slides to tell you something about triggers. The second ingredient is backgrounds. Backgrounds, 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 okay? We need to understand for a search the standard model backgrounds and the instrumental backgrounds. By instrumental backgrounds, I mean, you know, all sorts of weird things that can happen. Backgrounds from the machines, background from cosmic rays, backgrounds from misidentifying an electron as a photon or whatnot, or a jet as an electron. And so this is what I call instrumental backgrounds. And as an experimentalist, we are mostly in charge of this, and we'll do the best job that we can. But for the physics backgrounds, the standard model backgrounds, we need a lot of help from the theory. Okay? And of course, there are exceptions to this, but this is generally this is a general rule of thumb. And then you have to search for something, and of course, if you look for something, you may not find it, but if you don't look, you will never find it. It's obvious, but I'll show you some examples of unexpected physics signals that have been in people's data set for 15 years, and nobody saw them, nobody realized them because nobody looked. So here there's an issue of whether you do a search that is model independent versus model dependent, and I'll have some comments about that. But next, let me spend a few minutes talking about the trigger. Oops, the other way. Okay, the inelastic cross-section. So this is the cross-section for an interaction to happen, effectively, is huge, is 100 millibarns. Now, at very low luminosity, we say low luminosity, but this is a huge luminosity for a Hadron machine, but okay, a low luminosity LHC, 10 to the 33, the event rate is 100 megahertz, okay? The data acquisition capability is about 100 hertz. So you keep one event out of a million. Most of the events are thrown away. So it's important to realize this and to have a feeling for what is it that the experimenters are actually triggering on. So this is an example of a possible CMS trigger menu at low luminosity, 2×10^33. And this is already breaking the budget, by the way, but okay, by not by much. And this is a first pass list, and there will be many more things in the list. But for example, we trigger on electrons, and the threshold at this very low luminosity is foreseen to be about 30 GeV PT. So this means that if you have a physics signal with a single electron, it has to have about 30 GeV before it gets recorded. Now, this is really quite amazing, because people in other fields complain to me that no progress is being made in particle physics, in experimental particle physics. And remember, a W boson has a PT of the electrons that vary between 20 and 40 GeV. So 20 years ago, we had Carlo Rubbia giving talks showing these 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 candidate events for a W boson, and now we are throwing most of them away, and we don't even worry about it, okay? And also, this throws away a lot of top events, because the electrons from top events also have about 20 GeV. And by the way, this trigger also requires the electron to be somewhat isolated. Now we can also trigger on two electrons, and so if you're looking for two electrons, you can lower the threshold, and the threshold will be in this straw menu about 17 GeV. Photons, 80 GeV. If there is an event with a photon of 50 GeV, we're never even going to look at it. Well, that's not quite true, because there will be other triggers with lower thresholds, which will be pre-scaled, meaning that we will take 1 in n, 1 in 10, or 1 in 100, or 1 in 1,000, okay? But 80 GeV, two photons, one of 40 GeV and one of 25 GeV. Muons, 20 GeV or so. Two muons, 7 GeV. Taus, 86 GeV. 86. Two taus, 60 GeV. One jet and missing energy. One jet of 180 and missing energy 123. These guys have been very precise. One jet or three jets or four jets. One jet of 657 or three jets of 247 or four jets of 113 each. Okay, an electron and a jet, something like this, inclusive B jets. 240 GeV. Okay. Other stuff, miscellaneous stuff. So, and this is at low luminosity. So you have to be aware of this. You have to, the message that you should come out with from this is that we trigger on leptons, on combinations of leptons, and the thresholds are fairly high. So if you didn't trigger, it never happened. So what are the ingredients for a discovery? Well, the discovery will be made of some carefully crafted combinations of photons, electrons, muons, taus, jets, BTAG jets, and missing energy. Okay, so these are the objects in an event that you have to play with, and you put them together in whatever way to look for physics beyond the standard model. This is most cases, but not necessarily. There could be something much more exotic, like a heavy charged particle that moves very slow, and for which the signature would be somewhat different. But you know, in general, this is the menu of ingredients that you have to put together and make your soup. So I think it's good to look at these ingredients and develop some intuition about them, and in particular, develop some intuition on what the backgrounds are to this signature, because in most cases, of course, the physics beyond the standard model will have low cross sections, and you'll have to fight backgrounds from standard model cross sections. So jets are everywhere. That's the first rule of thumb in a hadron collider. Jets are everywhere, and jets can fake just about everything. So, and because they are everywhere, even if the probability of faking something is very small, you have to worry about it. So A jet can fake an isolated photon, an isolated electron, an isolated muon, it can fake a tau. And how often does this happen? So let's look at some data from the current Pevatron experiments. This is not from CMS or Atlas, but I expect that CMS and Atlas will have about the same capabilities in this. There's no big magic breakthrough or big difference. So this is from a PhD thesis from a student in D0. And this shows the probability that a jet fakes a photon in the D0 detector as a function of transverse energy. And this is for one, this is in the central rapidity region, and no, sorry, this is in the central rapidity region, and this is in the NCAP region. The units are 10 to the minus 3. Okay? So the probability of faking a jet fakes a photon is in D0 is a few 10 to the minus 4. And so this is a number to keep in mind. Another thing to keep in mind is not how big these error bars are. And the reason that these error bars are big is because it's really difficult to measure this fake probability. So this is known to about 30-40% in D0. Okay? So you have a probability of faking of a few 10 to the minus 4, and it's not known very well. The probability of faking an electron or a muon is about an order of magnitude smaller, but you have to realize that some jets have real leptons in them, like jets from B quarks, because the B quarks can decay into electrons and muons. And so then the probability of faking becomes much, much more complicated. It depends on whether the jet was a jet from light quarks or a jet from B quarks. Okay? The probability of faking a tau, this was one of your students, John, right? The probability of faking a tau is a few 10 to the minus 3. This is from CDF. This was from one of John's students at DPF. And it changes with the cluster, the energy, but it's a few tenths of a percent. Okay? Light quark or gluon jets can fake B quarks. B quarks are important. They are third generation. They are parts of lots of new physics signatures, and so it's important to separate a B quark from a UDS or gluon jet. So a B jet from a UDS gluon jet, but it's not perfect. So this shows the mistag rate, which is the probability that you make a mistake. You take a UDS jet and you call it a B jet. As a function of the ET of the jets, this is from CDF, one of the two experiments at the Tevatron, and the CDF people have a couple of algorithms. This is tight, this is loose, but it's a few percent. So light quark and gluon jets fake B quarks at a few percent level, and I expect that this will more or less hold at the LHC, within a factor of, I don't know, 3 or so. Missing transverse energy is an important, very important component of any searches at the LHC. And this is actually the thing that is most difficult to develop an intuition for. Fake missing energy mostly comes from jet resolution and also tails. And the other thing that you should realize about jets is that jets are measured very badly, or pretty badly. So this is a CMS simulation now that shows the resolution of the jet energy measurement as a function of the jet energy. So over here, at high energy, there is a resolution of about 15%. So you measure these jets with a resolution of 15%, and the mistake that you make in the measurement of the jet energy translate almost directly into missing energy. And then there's all the dirty laundry, because anything that goes wrong in the detector or any backgrounds from the accelerator or anything else tends to cause missing energy. And so in order to get rid of the tails, you have to do a lot of work. This is a plot that I stole from D0, which shows the missing energy distribution in some categories of their events. I guess this must be their missing energy triggers. And it looks like this. It's even got a bump here. and then they remove the bad runs, and because the bad runs meaning runs where something was wrong in the detector, and so all of these events go away. Then they remove noisy events, and all of this stuff goes away. And then they also remove bad cells and bad towers, whatever that means. They're just cleaning up these messy events. Now, it's not like you have the detector malfunction and it's bad all the time. But the problem is that even for the one event where something bad happens, it's going to show up immediately into missing energy. So you have to clean it up, and this is a lot of work and has to be done very carefully. So it doesn't come for free. Another interesting thing is that you get contributions to missing energy just from a minimum bias, or the underlying event. And this shows, and then the underlying event is what happens to the rest of the pieces of the proton and the two protons that do not participate in the hard scatter. That the activity in that event is roughly equivalent to what happens on a minimum bias event, which is an event that is triggered just on the fact that an interaction happened. So this is a simulation of the CMS detector, and so what's looking for minimum bias events, and this, what's plotted here is the missing energy in a random direction. So the missing energy in the x-axis. Okay. Remember, the missing energy is a vector. It has a magnitude, but also a direction. So you look at the x component of missing energy, and you look how big it is. And from resolution effects and whatnot, and it has a sigma of 6 GeV. So each component of missing energy for each minimum bias event has a random 6 GeV of missing energy thrown in. Okay, and actually, this is not... There's actually some controversy about whether we really know what this is going to be at the LHC. We would measure it, of course, but if you talk to people like Ian Inchliffe, he will tell you that we have no idea, and this could be three times bigger. So, this also sets the scale of how precise you can do things. There are tens of GeV of missing energy floating around. Yeah, and these are not in here. This would be part of the cleanup that you would have to do here somehow. This is the state of the art of the simulation as of some time ago. So what's my message here? My message is that a little bit of intuition goes a long way, and you need to develop some intuition about cross-sections, about triggers, about fakes. And you need that if you want to estimate whether something can be done or not. And as I said, the hardest intuition, at least for me, is on the missing energy tails. This is for one single minimum bias event. This is for no pileup. Then you add the pileup, it gets worse. Okay. Well, you add 6 GeV per event. So No, you don't add 6 GeV per event. That's not true. What is the John, if you open a cone, is a few GeV of minimum bias, right? 4 GeV per cone, yeah. So you add 4 GeV per interaction on top. Yeah, but they're not. It's not. I would guess, yeah, the question is what is the fluctuation? And the fluctuation is probably as big as that. Well, right. It's unknown. That's what I was mentioning.
Remember, it's not Gaussian. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so there are easy tools to calculate cross sections and to take quick looks, like look at kinematical distribution for many lowest order processes, for example, CompHEP, that I find useful when I try to think about some signature to just run this program and really fairly quickly get an idea at the order of magnitude level at what the backgrounds are, what the distributions look like, etc. So this is also a tool. These kinds of tools are useful tools that now exist, and it's great. And you don't need all the big machinery of the big experiments with these big programs, these complicated Monte Carlos to do this. These are fairly simple tools that you can just download from the internet, and in an hour or so you can just get them to run on your machine. Okay, so now I want to talk about different types of discoveries at the LHC. And I've divided the discoveries into three arbitrary categories. First category is a self-calibrating discovery, like a mass peak. The second category is a counting experiment. Well, a counting experiment is where you find that the number of observed events of some type is much, much greater than the standard model prediction. And the third category is when you look at distribution. So the distribution of some kinematical quantity is inconsistent with the standard model predictions. These are broad categories, and there is some overlap, and the distinction is not always clean, but I do find it useful to think in those terms. A self-calibrating one, a counting experiment, and a distribution. So a self-calibrating signal is a signal that is so big and so obvious that punches you in the face, but you do not really need to know the standard model background very well, because you know that there is no way the standard model can do this. Well, okay, you have to be careful because you can make a mistake here, but this is the general category. And for example, a mass peak would be in this category. You find a mass peak in a distribution where the standard model has no particles, and that should be a signal for new physics. Or a huge distortion on some kinematical distributions. Or something truly weird, like a heavy, slow charged particle that doesn't exist in the standard model, and you find evidence for that. So let me give you some example. An example would be the decay of a new neutral vector boson called a Z prime, in analogy with a Z, that decays to two muons. And these are CMS simulations, not the most recent ones, but they're good enough. This shows the rate on a log scale of dimuon events as a function of the invariant mass of the dimuon. And you have a contribution from Drell-Yan. This is PP goes to mu plus mu minus plus something else, mostly through a virtual photon or a virtual Z that falls smoothly with mass. You have a contribution from Di boson production, so production of two Ws or two Zs in the same events. You have a contribution from TT bar, the top quarks can decay into muons, so they can give you two muons. And then suppose you have a 3TeV new particle that is produced with the exact same couplings as the standard model, this is what it will look like. Now, if you have a distribution like this, we're not going to be worrying about whether this green line looks like this or looks like that, because it doesn't give you a peak. So this is self-calibrating. This is what a 100 inverse picobarn experiment might look like for a 1 TeV Z prime going to mu plus mu minus in CMS. So you would have a handful of events up here, and then you will have a concentration of events here. And these people have done careful studies, and this is the reach of in mass for different models for this Z prime with standard model coupling, Z prime with left-right symmetric models, a Z prime from E6 models. But you can see that you are, with one picobarn, you get about a limit, your sensitivity of close to, is that picobarn? That's femtobarn, yeah. With one femtobarn, you get sensitivities of order 1.5 TeV. And now here's, I told you the rule of thumb, you don't gain very much with luminosity, right? So now if you go to 10 femtobarns, you get from 1.5 or so to 2.2 or so. Okay, so you win, you don't win very fast by accumulating much more data. The way you win in this game is by energy. That's mu plus mu minus only, then if you put it plus e minus, it's gonna look something like this also. It's sort of like doubling. The first order should be like doubling the luminosity. Although at very high energy, there are issues with resolution that comes into place, but okay. Here's another example of a SCS, self-calibrating search. You can find resonances in two jet events. Now you have two jet events are everywhere, because jets are everywhere and most jets come from two jet events, and you have all these events. It would just be stupid to not look at the invariant mass of these two objects, right? Who knows? Okay, so there are some theories here that can give you the resonances in two jet events, and here are some rules of thumbs. If they're produced strongly, they have about the same cross sections at QCD at the same mass, and so they're easy to see. If they're produced weakly, it's going to be tougher. So this is a CMS simulation. This is what is this? This is I forgot what does. Oh, this is the excited quark. This is the DiJet invariant mass prediction from QCD. Looks like this. You know, notice that this is a log scale. It falls like a rock. And this is what would happen if you had a 1 TeV excited quark on top of it. You would be adding this contribution on top, so you would see a little bump here. This is for 2, this is for 5. So this would be, an excited quark is something that would be produced strongly, and so not surprisingly, it has essentially the same cross-section of QCD. On the other hand, if it's something like it that is produced weakly, it's going to have a cross-section lower than QCD. So this would be a Z prime. If a Z prime looks like is like a normal Z, as well as decay into mu plus mu minus, is also going to decay into QQ bar, and so it will show up as a peak in the QCD DiJet mass, but it's much lower in rate, and so it's going to be much tougher to discover. Now. Yeah, pretty much. Yes.
You're ignoring the combinatorics?
No, I'm not. They are not ignoring the combinatorics.
This is. Yeah, resonance.
These are resonances. Yeah. So this would be PP. Good. Yeah. Okay. If it's okay, right. So if you require two BTACs, what's going to happen? The QCD is going to go down. By how much? Well, there's going to be a BB bar production, which is some fraction of this, and there's also going to be the fake from UDS, which I told you was about a few percent per jet, and so if you require two B tags, it would be a few percent squared, which would be about 10 to the minus 3, so just by fakes, you're going to go down by 3 orders of magnitude. So, you see, this is exactly an example of why a feel for these numbers is useful, because you can sort of quickly make orders of magnitude estimates. And you have to be careful, because sometimes your order of magnitude estimates are very wrong. Okay, but now when you look at this data, actually, the way this data is usually shown is this way, where you, this is being cut off. This would be the same plot as before, but now we see, for some data, the fractional difference between the QCD prediction and the data. And so, if you only had QCD, all of your points would be lining up here. And if you have a resonance, you will get something like this. Okay. And this is what, this again is CMS, this is what an excited quark or an E6D quark would look like for a 1 inverse femtobond luminosity. Okay? And these people have done some studies, and this is the kind of exclusion regions that, assuming that this is not, well, this is the sensitivity that you have in these different models. Different models have different couplings, etc. So the sensitivity is a little bit different. But again, here, so the blue one is where the Tevatron is now. It's going to get a little better. And yellow, green, and red is where CMS is going to get in 100 picobond, 1 femtobond, and 10 femtobond. And again, here you see, for example, for E6D quarks, diquarks, 100 inverse picobond CMS has a sensitivity up to 4 TeV, and a 1 and a 10 inverse femtobond CMS, so 100 times more data in the red. This should be red. I don't know why it's orange. 100 times more data here than here moves you from 4 TeV to 6 TeV. Again, you don't gain very much by luminosity. But of course, if it happens to be at 5 TeV, you're going to love having that extra luminosity. Okay, so I'm sort of dwelling on this jet distribution because I want to make a point eventually. So be patient. Another self-calibrating signal is to just not look for a peak in the diejet mass distribution, but look for a distortion. So the QCD background in the diejet mass or the jet PT, doesn't matter, is going to look like that, and you're looking for a distortion. And a distortion would come from more scatters at high angles, more jets at high PT, or more diejets at high mass. And this is actually pretty cool because it's like doing Rutherford scattering with quarks. That's basically what it is. And so this is often parameterized by a quark contact interaction, and this lambda here would be related to the size of the compositeness of the quark if it was because of quark compositeness. Now, if this edge here, where the departure from QCD happens, is low enough, this could be a relatively easy discovery, because if you see the distribution goes like that, and then here it gets flat, well, there's no way that QCD does that. Okay? So if it's over here, it's a self-calibrating discovery. If it happens over here and it's marginal, it's not a self-calibrating discovery. It's much tougher. And let me show you here again some prediction for CMS. This is the diejet mass. Again, in this case, actually, we do a trick. We do a ratio of events at high eta versus low eta, high rapidity versus low rapidity. This is a variable that eliminates many experimental uncertainties, it turns out. I'm getting there. That's the point I want to make. Because we find it's hard to do a calibration of the energy scale for jets. That's a very hard business. And so if you get the energy scale wrong, then you're going to get this curve wrong. But it's easy to get a relative calibration across the detector. So if you take ratios. Not this. Not the jets. These are jets. No, these are the jets are your signal. But when my detector reconstructs the jets and it says the energy is 120 GeV, and I want the energy of the parton, there's a transfer function from that and measured energy to the energy of the parton, which has all sorts of dirty laundry, as you might imagine. But getting that transfer function is not easy. So. But it's easy to equalize the response across the calorimeter. That we know how to do. Yeah, this transfer function is a function of PT and a function of calorimeter coordinate. So getting the calorimeter coordinate part is easy. Getting the PT part is more difficult. So if we just take a ratio of events at low rapidity versus high rapidity, the signal is mostly the low rapidity, we cancel out the PT dependence to a large extent. Okay? Okay. So again, this is all, this is always plotted as a function of so here the diget mass as a function of so this is the ratio, and QCD says that this should be the ratio, and this would be a 5 TeV contact interaction at 100 picobar. I am not sure. I was trying to find out last night exactly what they meant. It's so it's it comes from it's here, but exactly what the structure is in this particular model, I don't remember. I couldn't find out yesterday when I looked at it. Okay, so these are the sensitivities against CMS. Under inverse picobar, you probe, if you look at the exclusions, assuming that this doesn't occur, 6 TeV. And then if you go to 10 inverse femtobar, you only get a factor of 2 for a factor of 100 in luminosity. Okay, this is another self-calibrating discovery. If you look, if you find a distribution, like if you take the mass of some lepton pair, lepton plus, lepton minus, and you plot it, and you find that it looks like this, well, with a sharp edge here, well, there's no way that the standard model is going to make this sharp edge. And for example, some supersymmetric decays like this will give you this sharp edge, and of course the position of this edge is related to the mass of this particle here. Okay, so this is another self-calibrating. Of course, not all that glitters is gold, and the history of particle physics is littered with self-calibrating discoveries that were not discoveries. So this is kind of the hall of shame. This is a signal in a Upsilon decay, and this is the gamma energy signal. There's a very nice peak. I mean, there's no way that the standard model can give you a distribution like this, but it turned out to be completely wrong. This is... we were too young.
Crystal ball
in the 80s. They repeated the analysis with the exact same cuts with the data from the next year, and it was a completely smooth distribution.
It's very hard to extract the results.
Yeah. So. These are leptoquarks, a putative leptoquark signal from H1 at HERA from about 10 years ago. This was a low statistic signal, so this was probably low statistic. So buyer beware, especially in the tails of distributions. This is data, is fairly recent data from a few years ago from an experiment at JLab. There are actually lots of experiments that have claimed the existence of a pentaquark. A pentaquark would be a new particle made up of 4 quarks and 1 antiquark, and you know, there's a nice peak here, my goodness. But this is not, a lot of other experiments have looked for this signal and I've not seen it, and they should have seen it, and so this is, I don't know if it's officially dead or not, but it's, let's put it this way, it's almost dead. This is a hall of shame from UA1 in about 20 years ago, and this is a search for the top quark, and they present these events here. This is from their paper. This is the mass of the lepton neutrino and the two jets, because they look for W to top B, and then the top goes to lepton neutrino bottom. So if you get both bottoms, the one from the W decay and the one from the top decay, and the lepton and the neutrino somehow, they should peak at the W mass, and wow, it does. And if you look at the lepton neutrino, one of the quarks, it should peak at the top mass, and wow, it does, and there's nothing else, and this was completely wrong. It's low statistics. So buyer beware, particularly in the tails of the distributions, and when they don't show you what's going on over here, you should be particularly suspicious. Okay, so this is an aside. I talked about the tail of the DiGet invariant mass, or the tail of the JET distribution. This is not a self-calibrating signal, but this is what happened 10 years ago. CDF published this data. This is JET-PT distribution, the dots are data, and the line is the standard model. It's QCD, and if you look here, it looks like these points in at the edges are above the curve. Now, if you plot it, this is, again, as data minus theory divided by theory, so if the theory is right, you should get a flat line at zero. You'll find that there is a discrepancy. These points go up. And of course, this QCD prediction is not unique. You can put in different Python distribution function, and you get different predictions. So at the time, these were the most popular Python distribution functions. So people, they used this one, MRSA prime, as their default. Then they tried MRSG and looked something different, CTEC2M, CTEC2ML, GRV94. They looked all a little different, but none of them could actually reproduce this rise. And the CDF people were convinced that this rise was not because they screwed up the experiment, but it was real. So the data in the tail was not consistent with QCD and the existing sets of Parton distribution function. It looks like a contact term with a parameter lambda of 1.6 TeV. But of course, what happened? You don't learn in particle physics class that there is a compositeness. And what happened was that a further analysis of the Parton distribution functions found that the discrepancy could be absorbed modifying the gluon distributions without conflicting with other data, even though all existing PDF fits were low. Well, why were all existing PDF fits low? Well, they were all low because they all used the same data, of course. So it's slightly different. This was slightly different interpretation of the same data. They weren't wrong. Now, the modern Parton distribution functions actually include uncertainties. At the time, there were no uncertainties available for this Parton distribution function. As a poor experimenter, the only thing that I could do is run the standard model with different Parton distribution functions and see what I got. And none of them agreed with the theory. So now we have uncertainties built in the Parton distribution functions, and this is a great step forward, okay? And to me, this is an example of some careful work on the phenomenological side that has a major impact. And when I talk about this to some of my theorist friends, they tell me that it's boring. And yes, it is boring, but sometimes boring stuff is important, okay? And so this kind of work is very important. And I think it's not appreciated enough. Yes. Yes. I mean, this is one of the very first plot that we're going to make. It's one of the easiest plot. Well, if you take it's going to be easy if you take the ratio. It's going to be an easy plot to make, and there will be some back and forth here. Okay. Now so I have three categories, if you remember: self-calibratings, counting experiments, and shapes. So now let's talk about counting experiments and shapes. So not all new physics signals are as dramatic as a mass peak. If it was just a mass peak, that would be easy. That would be great. So you do an analysis. You're looking for new physics, and you need to establish whether the data are or are not compatible with the standard model. So you need the standard model prediction. Backgrounds. In some cases, the standard model prediction comes entirely from the experiments, and it's data-driven. And since I'm an experimentalist, I put my editorial comment here, which says that's robust. Robust because it's in my hands. In other cases, the standard model prediction relies heavily on the theory. And again, my editorial comment as an experimentalist is that this is not so robust. So I want to give you a couple of examples to understand what the typical issues might be. So this is an example from a search in CDF for new physics in leptons, photon, and missing ET. Now, I'm not a member of the CDF collaboration, but we had a seminar here a few months ago that talked about this analysis, and I thought it was a, it was a very instructive example. And if I say something wrong, John can correct me. So this is a fairly simple final state, lepton, photon, missing energy, okay? And so there was a search at CDF for this final state, and this is actually motivated by the fact that there was something, an indication of something weird going on in this channel in the data taken 10 years ago in REN1. So this is a fairly simple search. You select events, and then we compare with what you expect from the standard models. And you compare both the numbers of events, how many events you get, and what do the kinematic of distributions look like. Now, you're going to get events. And so this requires a very careful accounting of all of the standard model sources. And this is a lot of work. And it's typical for this type of searches. You have to painstakingly account for each background source that you can think of. And there are going to be many. And you don't just run some magical Monte Carlo and get an answer out and then compare with that answer. That's not the way it works. So remember, lepton, photon, missing energy. So what are these backgrounds? The first background is you have a lepton and missing energy. So you have a lepton and a neutrino. Well, a lepton and a neutrino can come from a W. So you can have a W plus a jet. The W goes to lepton and neutrino. And then the jet fakes the photon. Remember, we said the jet fakes the photon at the 10 to the minus 3 level or so. So you got to estimate what this background is. And so this is estimated from the data itself, from the observed rate of W plus jets, and then for the measured probability that a jet fakes a photon. And this is, and the first part is easy. The second part is less easy. And in fact, this particular component to the background calculation at 100% uncertainty, but it's completely data-driven. It's completely in the hands of the experimenter. Then you can have something pretty weird. You can have, for example, E plus E minus pairs, and one of the electrons, as it goes through the material in the tracker, for example, or to the beam pipe, radiates a hard photon, and you lose the electron. It turns itself into a photon. Pretty weird stuff, but it does happen. And you have to account for it, because then you will get a lepton and a photon, but it really was two leptons, okay? And also on top of it, the missing energy fluctuates high. So how do you do that? Well, you have a sample of Z to electrons, which is large, and you look for a sample of Z to one electron and one something that looks like a photon, and you observe missing ET distribution, and from that you can estimate what this background is. Okay, so this is data-driven. Again, it's good. It's in my hands as an experimentalist. I'm happy. A lot of work, but I'm happy. Then you have PP bar goes to jets, and the jet fakes a lepton. Now, this is, again, is estimated from the data by relaxing the lepton quality requirements, extrapolating, looking in various samples. Again, a lot of work, but it can be done. Then we come to the main background, which turns out to be physics. Lepton, photon, missing energy. Well, you can make a W in conjunction with a gamma or a Z in conjunction with a gamma that gives you a lepton, a photon, and missing energy. And this turns out to be the main background, but it's not instrumental, especially the W gamma. It's W goes to lepton, gamma, missing energy. It's really the ingredient, the electron, the photon, the missing energy are real. It's a real electron, it's a real photon, it's a real neutrino. So you need theoretical input. And what are your tools? Your tools are a leading order parton level event generator, which you have to interface to a showering Monte Carlo like Pythia. And actually, this particular analysis used more than one because, I don't know, majority logic, they didn't agree. And so you have to spend a lot of time making these parton level event generators agree. And then there is a next leading order calculation. Okay. So this is a good case, because the next to leading order calculation is there. It exists. Often, it does not exist. Now, the K factor in this case, which is the ratio of cross-section, next to leading order to leading order, is 1.5, but it also varies across phase space. So you cannot take the leading order Monte Carlo, just multiply by 1.5, but the experimenters had to fudge somehow pretty dirty work how the leading order Monte Carlo the leading order Monte Carlo outputs to sort of mimic the next leading order distribution. So what do you get out of this? Oh, this is actually the paper that calculated this, the next leading order for pp bar to w gamma and z gamma. This is, I plotted the z gamma because they didn't have the equivalent plot for the w gamma. But this is, at the Tevatron, the ratio of cross section as a function of the pt of the photon. You might imagine that the pt of the photon in this search is a very important quantity, because maybe new physics is going to give you hard photons and old physics is going to give you soft photons. And this is how, this is the ratio of next leading order to the leading order calculation as a function of the photon pt, and it changes a little bit. And even though this was, well, they also did the same calculation for the LHC, and my goodness, this changes a lot. I have no idea why it changes more. But you see that next leading order is not just a change in cross section; it also changes the shapes of distribution. And these are some parameters. I don't remember what they are. So this is what their data looks like. So this is what this again CDF. This is the energy of the photon. This is the lepton ET. This is the missing energy. This is the transverse mass of lepton, missing energy, photon. So these are kinematic of distribution that they could think of. The points are the data. The histogram is the background prediction, the standard model prediction. And so they find decent agreement in shape and normalization. And you see, this is the kind of tables that come out of an analysis like this. All the standard model sources, painfully accounted for. Some of them I didn't talk about because they were small, but they had to go to the trouble of proving that they're small. And you add them all. The biggest one is just W gamma, 21 events. They add them all up, they get 35 events with an uncertainty of 5, and in the data they have 43. Now, if you did not have the next leading order calculation, and this is my interpretation, this prediction would have been 26. So it would be 26 events and 43 observed. So what do you conclude? I mean, how big an excess do you have before you can think that you are safely away from the from a standard model, that a contribution that you haven't fully calculated? So you would have made the error bigger, of course. Yes. It would have been 26 plus or minus, depending on your religion. If it was me, it would have been 26 plus or minus 20 or so, but okay. Okay, but so what is the message here? The message here is that getting these higher order calculations is a big help in trying to find these excesses of events or difference in shapes over standard model predictions. Here's another example. This is ancient. Is the search for top at UA2, almost 20 years ago. But this is a nice example because this is a search based on a shape analysis that is completely independent of theoretical assumptions, besides special relativity, I guess. So this actually sometimes happens, and when it happens, as an experimentalist, I'm happy. So what did they look for? They looked for W to T B bar, and T to E nu B. So they were looking for top quarks with masses below the W mass. So in this decay chain, clearly the mass of the electron neutrino is lower than the mass of the W. And their background is W plus jets, and in this case the mass of the electron neutrino is equal to the mass of the W. So you take the electron neutrino and you plot, and if you could plot their masses, you could get rid of all of the background. Of course, you cannot plot the mass of an electron and a neutrino because you're missing the longitudinal component of the neutrino momentum. But you can plot the next best thing, which is the transverse mass. The transverse mass is like a mass calculated only using the transverse components. And if you go through the math of this, it has a Jacobian peak at the W mass. So this is what their data look like. So this was the best. So the histogram is the data. The curve is the best fit without the top signal. And now if there was a top quark at 65 GeV, this curve would have been modified like this. And so by seeing how well the modified curve agrees with the data, they can set limits on the top quark mass. And so this was now a search which is just based on a shape, but there are no theoretical assumptions. So this happens. Again, going to the top quark, this is a search for the top quark, also ancient. This is CDF 1994. But it's an example of a counting experiment. A counting experiment is where you just count how many events you get, and you compare with the backgrounds. And this is also independent of theoretical assumptions. So this is another one that I like. So the signal is lepton plus missing energy plus greater than or equal to 3 jets, and greater than or equal to 1 is tagged as a B. The background is a W plus jets with a B tag that is faked, or a W plus BB bar with a B tag that is real. And in this case, one of the background estimates was entirely data-driven. So we measured the B tagging rate per jets in PP bar goes to jets. This includes fakes and real tags. And then we make the conservative assumption that there are more B, real B quark in PP bar decay, PP bar event, PP bar to jets events than in W plus jets. This is a very safe assumption. And so we get a background estimate that is an overestimate. And the background estimate is over here. And you see that this is the counting experiment, a number of events versus jets. And here there's an excess, and this excess was part of the first evidence for the existence of the top quark. And then you use the sidebands here of low number of jets to validate your calculation. Okay, so my comments. Unfortunately, the background estimations that are purely data-driven often do not work, and you need to subtract standard model processes using theoretical expectation for their cross-section. At lowest order, we have large normalization uncertainties, and this makes the counting experiments more difficult. And the lowest order event generators can also have large shape uncertainties, and this makes the shape analysis difficult. Particularly, it makes it very difficult to do sophisticated statistical tests, which people like to do. Because how do you actually quantify the error in something like this? I mean, you can do all the fancy statistical tests that you want, but if the error comes out of thin air, it's the whole analysis comes out of thin air. So what are the uncertainties at leading order versus what are the next leading order? Often you can get a handle from the data. Where is the smoking gun? So as an experimentalist, I'm more comfortable if the uncertainties are under my control. I screw up, it's my fault. If you as a theorist might feel differently. And should you ask how sausages are made? So what can theorists do for experiments? I stole this slide from Zvi Bern at this meeting here. So experiments to theorists, get to work. Calculate all of this at next to leading order, please. It's a lot of theses, okay? Theories to experimenters in your dreams. No way. More realistic experimenters wish list. So, okay, we iterate. Okay, if you guys don't want to do all of this, do this, okay? So these are processes that are important at the LHC we'll be standard model backgrounds to various searches like the search for the Higgs boson, and so calculate as this, okay? And then, of course, not only that, but please, please, please implement these calculations in a Monte Carlo so that we can actually use them without having to fudge them, okay? And there is some work going on in next to leading order Monte Carlos. Again, this is not very glamorous work, it's nuts and bolts work, but nuts and bolts contributions can be more useful suggestion for yet another beyond the standard model theory. And again, when I tell this to some theorist friends, they tell me, but this is boring. And I say, well, you know, if you want to get really bored, come to my lab and try to fix my water leak, okay? So, you know, life is not all glory. There's also grunge work that needs to be done. So model-dependent versus model-independent searches. Oh, wow, look at that. We can search for generic new physics signatures or for very specific complicated signatures. Like this one. But because we do not know what the new physics is, generic searches are very powerful. But in a generic search, you worry about a missing complicated signature. you worry about missing it. Fortunately, we have 1,000 physicists, so that should be okay. So this is an interesting plot. Most of you probably haven't paid any attention to this. But this is data that came out a few years ago. This is the invariant mass of a KK pi pi zero, where the KK pi is consistent with a D sub S, when a D sub S is the lowest lying CS bar state. And you find a peak here, which is the first excited state, which was well known. And then you find this huge peak, humongous peak. This humongous peak has been there, has been in people's data for 20 years. But nobody ever looked, because this next excited state was supposed to be on this side of the decay threshold, and so it was supposed to be very, very wide, okay? So what is hiding in the Tevatron data set, and what was missed by the Tevatron trigger? If you don't look for it, you'll never see it. This was huge, and as soon as people saw it, other people went back and found it in their data. Okay, shall I speed up? Okay, so this is a case study for the TT bar, the Tevatron. The question is, this was the high PT discovery of the Tevatron. It was not new physics, but it was the ultimate known unknown. And so a good question would it have been seen in a generic search? If you just do a generic search, would you have seen this? And I polled some of my friends, and we concluded that in the most high statistics channel, it would have taken a lot of time, because a lot of tools were developed just for this search. Eventually, it would have probably been showed up in the lower statistic channels with two leptons, and this is sort of an indication of the power of multi-lepton searches. Okay, if we see new physics, can we tell what it is? This is a great question, and this is why you guys are here. But I must make a confession that this is not what keeps me alive at night, awake at night. Let's first make a discovery, and then we'll figure out what it is. The emphasis is going to shift to, given that you see a signal for X, if the new physics is Y, should you see Z? You should see Z, go look for Z. And suggesting where Z is experimentally impossible and not very useful, that's obvious. So, of course, you should not underestimate your experimental colleagues, but the point here is that a well-developed feel for the experimental issues will make a big difference when we get to the next step. And this is my last slide here. Long wait, exploration of the TV scale is about to start. There are many ideas about new physics, and my message to you is that nuts and bolts contributions from the theory community are extremely important, and I think are underappreciated in general. Thank you. So in the end, I did keep you here for an hour plus, so I apologize. Do we have theorists in our experiment? Do we actually have theorists? Yeah, we have theorists, yes. He's not going to take shifts. Okay, so the question was, you have theorists in your experiments, and the answer is yes. They should be doing those calculations. The thing is that these calculations are very complicated, they're very time-consuming, they're very difficult, and this is why they're not being made. I don't think there's a fundamental principle, fundamental reason why they haven't been made, except that they're grungy and a lot of work and not very appreciated, I think. Yes. Okay. So the comment was there's a difference between making all this long list of calculations beforehand versus at some point the experimenters will see some hint of something in some channel, and then the theorists will get to work busily on that particular calculation that is particularly applicable to that channel. And the answer is, of course, that's what's going to happen. So the comment was that this will depend on the type of communication between theorists and experimenters. Yeah, but experimenters and theorists. Yeah, but you know, look, if we go back to, for example, this CDF thing here, this analysis here. Suppose there was no next to leading order calculation. And the prediction was 26, and this number came up to be 70. Okay, you can bet that the experimentalists will announce this after they are convinced that they haven't screwed up all of the other things. They will announce it right away. So whether you are in the collaboration, well, you know, if you are in the collaboration, you can get a jump start. But it's not like people are going to sit on this for a long time, especially because there are two experiments, right? If an analysis like this gets 70 events, and we are convinced that this is right, this will get announced, and then we'll get announced as an excess of lepton plus photon plus missing ET events over the currently available standard model prediction. So the next thing is make the standard model prediction to see whether it's right, as new physics. That's how it's going to play out. Of course, if we had them all available, it would make our lives a lot easier, right? But you know, things are not always clean.
Even if you don't know the possible distribution of the energy that we use in the solar network, how do you create a solution that you can use in the new part of this question of the distribution of the energy?
Okay, the question was how can we deal with the fact that the theorists can calculate the parton cross section, but we may not need know the parton distribution at high energy. Well, the parton distributions to first order, you know, they just depend on x, right? So you've measured them. To second order, we know how they evolve. Okay, so and to third order, there will be data coming out from these experiments that would constrain the parton distributions. A lot of the data to constrain the parton distribution, not the main part, but some of it comes from the Tevatron experiments, from hadronic colliders, for example, the production of jets and photons. Bounds the gluon parton distribution. The product, the rapidity distribution of produced W gives a handle on the difference between the U and the D parton distribution. So, and these things will come up, and so there will be refinements and more refinements. But to first order, I don't think that's a big issue. If we have the matrix element, we'll be in good shape. And then the parton distributions now have errors, so So if we trust that that is done correctly, again, don't ask how sausages are made, but if we trust that that's done correctly, we will be able to carry that error through. How long is it going to take until we understand our detector? The answer is I have no idea, but it's not going to be short. I define short as 6 months. No. Can I say what I think is going to be understood first? I think a lot of it depends on. So some of it depends on what hardware problems might pop up, and then there's understood at what level. Jets by themselves, understood at the 10% level, are fairly easy. And the requirements on the detector are fairly minimal. This is a, now my colleagues that worked on the calorimeters are going to shoot me. but these are fairly, especially for the Adrani calorimeters, are fairly standard in CMS, are fairly standard things. They've never been there. So I think JETS understood that the 5-10% levels will be first, if I had to guess. Missing ET will probably be last. And also JETS have the highest cross sections, and there are a lot of students hanging around waiting for a thesis to get out, and there will be a lot of theses. The first theses will be on minimum bias events and on JET events. Those will be the quickest ones, I guess, but we'll see. Are we better than Atlas? Where? I don't know. Where are we better than Atlas? Probably a better tracker, if it works. Of course, I work on the tracker, so. And so does he. So the question is, there are some models where there are slow particles, and the question is, what is the time window that the trigger and the DAQ reads out? John. It's really, for the tracker is restricted. For the silicon part of the tracker, maybe, yeah, it's one bucket, right? Yeah, one bucket. But the signal is long, right? The shaping time is 20 nanoseconds or so. So you still get signals from 20 nanoseconds earlier, but not from 20 nanoseconds later. No, I think the people in the AQ group know. It's not something that that I've been worrying about, so I'm not sure.
Enough.
Right. Yeah, probably the first thing that the reconstruction does is to throw them out. So that's what the standard reconstruction will do. So, oh, that's an out of time hit. I don't care about that, and we'll throw them out. So there will have to be someone in the collaboration that cares deeply about this and that fights the battle within the collaboration to not throw this information out, leave it there so that he can look at it because he's interested in this physics, and there's going to be a trade-off because it's going to cost processing time and storage time and whatnot, and this is a collaboration works, and then there's going to be a shootout because there will be ten other requests that have cost in bandwidth, in storage and execution time. That's what happens. Yeah, but there are slices in the calorimeter readout in CMS that can read before and after, and I don't know enough. Yeah.